UB Live at the National Science Complex of the State University of New York at Buffalo. I'm Dr. Michael Bozarth. The following presentation is a lecture delivered to my Psychology 451 course on drug addiction. The book is titled Fundamentals of Drug Addiction, A Psychobiological Approach. The book is currently in preparation with a spring 2013 anticipated publication date. Students enrolled in the course have access to printed text, study guides, and slides to support the learning objectives. These materials are not yet available to the general public. Sit back, enjoy, and learn. This presentation continues our discussion of topics in psychopharmacology which are essential for developing a better understanding of drug addiction. The focus of this presentation is on dose response analysis and on understanding efficacy and potency and how they're related to drug addiction. Dose response analysis is used to reveal important features about a drug's effect. So you have to have some basic background in how we analyze these things in our dose response analysis. This is a typical dose response analysis showing the effects of three different opioid analgesics. We have here heroin, morphine, and codeine. And what you see on the x-axis, typical portrayal, what you have on the x-axis are increasing doses of the drug. What you have on the y-axis is increasing effect that you're measuring. Could be a biochemical effect, could be a neurophysiological effect. In this case, it's a behavioral effect. Typical dose response curve, independent variable, that's the dose of drug manipulated on the bottom, dependent variable on the y-axis, analgesic effect here. You have a lot of different ways to measure analgesia. In fact, analgesia is technically what we call an empirical construct. There's no single definition for what it is. So you have what we call operational definitions, ways that we define it for the purpose of the experiment. Here, analgesia is being measured as Paul-Lick latency. A common method that's used with laboratory rodents is to put them on a hot plate. Hot plate is not so hot that it would injure tissue, but it's a little warm. Put them on the hot plate and then measure how long it takes before they're feeling the heat. Now, you can wait until they start skimpering and scampering and jumping up and down because they're on the hot coals, or you can measure the earliest sign that they're feeling the heat, which happens to be licking their paws for a rodent. In other words, a little rat will lick its paws, which they do anyway, grooming sometimes. And they'll start licking their paws a little bit, saying, my paw's getting kind of hot here on this hot plate. And then we say, okay, study over. So we usually use a hot plate temperature that will get them up to that paw lick response fairly quickly. So you expect to see them lick their paw within, if it's a rat without analgesic treatment, maybe within 15, 20, 30 seconds. And even with an analgesic, hopefully they're going to lick their paw within a short time frame, like maybe a minute. Usually the maximum time that it'll be tested, typically, when you put a ceiling on this, you put the rat on the hot plate for a maximum of 1 minute or 90 seconds or 2 minutes, a number like that. And then they're scored at the max category, maximum analgesia, if they don't do the response by then. That's a measure of analgesia. This is our dose. Now, if you look at this, you see the drug doses look really screwed up. That's because linear increases in drug doses do not give you linear increases in the response that you're studying. What you have to do instead is give proportional increases in drug doses, which is what you see here. The drug doses increase by a fixed percentage. This is using a logarithmic progression, which is going 1, 3, 10, 30, 100, 300, 1,000. That is a typical progression of doses used in pharmacology and psychopharmacology, and that's what we simply refer to as the 1-3-10 prescription. That could be 1 microgram, 3 micrograms, 10 micrograms, 30 micrograms, 100 micrograms, 1 gram, 3 grams, 10 grams, 30 grams. Now, the way this works, for those of you that understood this from chemistry, is it follows basic enzyme kinetics and what's called the law of mass action. And I can't explain that to you now, but if you really want to know about it, take my course in clinical psychopharmacology, and I'll have you doing the numbers. You can mathematically put this in a very simple equation, and what happens is you will generate this sigmoid curve. And that has to do with, presumably, the drug molecules binding with receptor molecules and then producing the biological response under study. Whether that's an excitatory response or a depressant effect doesn't really matter. It's the proportion of drug molecules bound with the available receptors. And that's a simple function of the law of mass action. You don't need to know where the numbers really come from, but there's a reason we use this type of progression. The other one commonly used is doubling and halving. 1 milligram, 2 milligrams, 4 milligrams, 8 milligrams, 16 milligrams, 32, 64, 128. 256, 512, 1,024. That's a doubling and halving. You go down the other way. 10 milligrams, 5 milligrams, 2.5 milligrams. When you use these logarithmic scales, logarithms are just proportional increases. Think of them as being percentage changes. Make it simple if you don't like logarithms. Think of it as percentages, which is really what they are. When you do these logarithmic progressions in dose, you get this typical sigmoid curve. Now, if you look at the curve, let's follow first the morphine effect, which will be our reference compound here, our prototypic opiate. What we see here is that you give small doses of morphine, you produce very small, if any, measurable effect. And you eventually reach a threshold dose where you start producing effects from the morphine, in this case, analgesia. Then as you administer the same dose increments, these are the same percent increases across all values here in the drug dose scale, as you continue this progression in dosing, what you see is you get progressively larger increases in the amount of analgesia or the amount of your dependent variable that's being produced. In other words, you're getting more and more analgesia as you administer higher and higher morphine doses. It reaches a point where you still get stronger effects on your dependent variable, but they're actually decelerating, or the shape or the slope of the curve is actually decreasing. Eventually, you reach a maximum effect that's produced by the compound under study, in this case morphine, and that's the maximum effect that's produced at any dose. No matter how much more you increase that dose, you're not going to produce a larger effect. That gives you an indication of what we call the drug's efficacy. Efficacy is defined as the maximum effect obtainable from a drug at any dose. I don't care how much you give, what's the maximum effect that drug will produce on your dependent variable, whether it's analgesia or sedation or locomotor stimulation in the case of a psychomotor stimulant. It's kind of interesting if you're into the math and you know about the law of mass action. You actually look at this. What happens is the slope is actually increasing with successive doses up to this midpoint, which is an inflection point, where after this midpoint, the slope is actually decreasing until finally it's flat. The slope is equal to zero on your regression line. So that's kind of a magic number. When we do the statistical analyses on dose response curve, we often use this midpoint, which produces the effect in 50% of your subjects, or produces 50% of the maximum effect. There's actually two different things there. When you're looking at quantile data, the behavior is either there or not there. For example, the effect of a sedative hypnotic on the induction of sleep. For the purposes of the experiment, you decide that the individual is either sleeping or not sleeping, but there's no halfway sleeping in the middle. What happens is you're doing a quantile dose response analysis then, and what you're actually going to measure is the percentage of subjects showing the effect. That's technically what an ED50 is. ED50 stands for effective dose 50, the dose effective for producing a response in 50% of your subject. Much like the term opiates to refer to opioids, ED50 really is not defined, strictly speaking, as the effect that reaches half maximum magnitude and a graded dose response. But the term's being used that way today, so we'll use it that way in my class as well. If you have a graded dose response, when you have increases in the dependent variable, that correspond to increases in the independent variable, but now it's graded magnitudes, in other words, analgesia. You have a little analgesia, a lot of analgesia, a really whole big bunch of analgesia, or max analgesia. If you're taking a stimulant, maybe you run 20% faster, 50% faster, or 100% faster, twice your normal running speed. Those are graded dose response curves, and again, you'll have this point that's associated now not with the dose that produces the effect in half of your subjects, that's quantile. You would have the dose associated with producing 50% of the maximum obtainable effect that can be produced by that compound. That's also called ED50. That's in a graded dose response curve. You understand the difference? Quantile is either there or not there, so it's percentage of subjects that show the response. Graded is different grades or magnitudes of the dependent variable, either 10% of the maximum response, 20% of the maximum response, or 100% of the maximum obtainable response. So those are graded variables like speeds in an automobile, and that's a graded dose response curve. We're going to use the term ED50 there to describe the dose of drug which produces 50% of the maximum obtainable effect. For most people, they don't even make a distinction here. Technically, there's an important difference in some perspectives of pharmacology. Now, if you look at this dose response curve, what you're going to see is you get this OG curve, which is typical of the effect of increasing drug dose on the response that's being measured. The center portion of this, usually the portion that lies between 20% of the maximum effect and 80% of the maximum effect, is often linear. See, that's pretty much a straight line. You could use linear regression analysis there. That's another reason we like that ED50 for comparisons that I'll tell you about in a moment. It follows all the nice assumptions of a linear analysis, a linear regression, the correlations that you would have learned about in statistics. So you can use all the kinds of numbers you'd use, like how high is the R value? What's the correlation coefficient? If it's an effect that follows the law of mass action very well, you're going to get a very high correlation coefficient. It might be 0.8, which is pretty good for psychology, but even 0.9, 0.95, 0.98, you're approaching 1. And the beauty of this is it means that you understand what's going on. Your dependent variable is following manipulations of your independent variable so well that you're explaining most of the variance. You're explaining most of that relationship. That's one of the reasons these things are so important. And a dose response analysis that looks like this is following the classic laws of pharmacology, so it's behaving right. So when you get dose response curves that look like this, and the old inverted U function, which happens way too often, it's suggesting that you really don't understand all the variables that's controlling the behavior under study. You're understanding part of the variable. But if you understand all the variables, you should get a nice, predictable, clean dose response curve that looks much like the one portrayed here. Now, back on our dose response curve. This is the effect produced by morphine. You see the maximum effect up here, minimum effect, the threshold down here, the ED50 in the middle. You can look at the same type of dose response analysis, but now use heroin instead of morphine, and exactly what you would expect happens. Heroin is more potent than morphine because it's more lipophilic and it gets in the brain faster. Since it gets in the brain faster, it's floating through the circulatory system for a shorter period of time, and it goes through the liver fewer passes to be metabolized or inactivated. So larger amounts actually get in, as well as those amounts get in more quickly. So the potency of heroin is increased over the potency of morphine, even though the heroin is diacetylmorphine and it's converted to morphine in the brain and the active ingredient is morphine. The potency of heroin is stronger, which now shifts the dose response curve to the left, indicating that smaller doses produce comparable effects that you see with morphine. And that's really what potency is all about. Potency is about the amount of drug required to produce a given level of effect. Well, what level is that? Is that the threshold level or is that the maximum level? Well, the level usually compared is the ED50, is the midpoint, 50% of the maximum obtainable response. Where you normally do a potency comparison is to look at the ED50 for heroin and compare that with the ED50 of morphine. And what you see from this diagram is the ED50 of morphine is about 10 milligrams per kilogram body weight. There's the 50% mark. There's a dose that corresponds to it. Now, what's the ED50 for heroin? Well, ED50, right, there's the 50. Read it down. That would be 3 milligrams. So you can produce the same effect with heroin that you produce with morphine. But what requires 10 milligrams of morphine to produce only requires 3 milligrams of heroin. It's more potent. We say roughly 3 times more potent. The dose response curves are actually parallel, which is cool. You can do statistical tests for how parallel they are. That suggests they're working on exactly the same receptor mechanism. The parallel dose response curves are what you would expect if the heroin's being converted to morphine, and morphine's actually binding with the receptor and now obeying the law of mass action and producing the biological response under study. So parallelism is one of the tests that you do in a formal dose response analysis. Efficacies of these two drugs are the same. Morphine and heroin both produce the same maximum effect. Again, exactly what you predict if the heroin is being converted to morphine to produce the biological response under study. If you add a third ligand or compound under study, codeine, to this analysis, what you see are two things. First of all, the dose response curve for the codeine is shifted to the right of the dose response curve for the morphine and for the heroin. That indicates that codeine is less potent at all doses that would be administered. So if you're looking for a threshold dose of codeine that would produce an effect, down here it might take 30 milligrams of codeine. That would produce an effect that's the same as 1 milligram of morphine, which produces the effect the same as 0.3 milligrams of heroin. But a more common reference point, again, is the ED50, 50% of the maximum effect. The ED50 for codeine in this particular example would be 1,000 milligrams, or one full gram, but the ED50 for morphine, as we just said, is 10 milligrams, while the ED50 for heroin is 0.3 milligrams. What you see from this analysis is that morphine is about 10 times more potent than is the codeine. You can produce comparable effects up to the ED50, half of the maximum effect. It just takes 10 times as much codeine to produce it as it would morphine. And if you're looking at heroin, it takes a third less heroin. So now if you do the comparison between heroin and codeine, you would find that heroin is about 30 times more potent than its codeine. Sorry, I got tongue-tied on that because that actually is not the potency difference. So my brain in the background said, well, I shouldn't use that number. It's a bad example. There is a big difference, but in actuality, about 12 to 1, the way I do it in my head real fast. 10 milligram morphine is about like 120 milligrams of codeine. But because these are hypothetical data, don't be prescribing drugs for your mom or dad or little cat or puppy or little brother based on these data. These are meant to illustrate the point. What I did is I stretched out the difference in this example between the codeine and the morphine. Now, the difference between the heroin and the morphine, that's a real value. That's about what the potency difference is. It runs anywhere from 3 to 1 to 5 to 1 potency ratio. Okay, do you understand how that dose response analysis works? You have a couple of points there to look at. First of all, you look at the shape of the dose response curve. Does it follow a normal OG? The general principle is higher drug dose, bigger effect, up to some maximum level. That maximum level is defined as the drug's efficacy, the maximum effect that the drug can produce. Now you have a second variable. The second variable is how much drug does it take to produce any given level of effect? And that has to do with potency. That's what the potency is. How much drug does it take to produce the effect? That doesn't say whether it produces the maximum effect or not. It's just how much drug does it take to produce an effect. In this case, codeine is less potent than morphine and heroin. But if you're only looking for a low level of analgesia, you can produce comparable analgesia with codeine or with morphine or with heroin. Which one you use is a matter of how much you want to administer to the subject. And because codeine in general has a lower abuse and addiction liability, codeine is controlled at a lower level on the DEA scheduling than is morphine. Now let's move on to our psychomotor stimulant example. Here we have a hypothetical dose response analysis for four different stimulants. What we have, first of all, for our reference compound, we're going to use cocaine. So if we look at a dose response analysis for cocaine, we see the nice OG that we expect following the law of mass action. We happen to be measuring in this particular experiment arousal level, but we're not measuring arousal level directly because arousal level, like analgesia, is an empirical construct. It's not something that can be defined by just one definition. So what we have to do is use an operational definition, how you define the construct for the purposes of your experiment. The operational definition here for arousal is a commonly used measure in rodents called locomotor activity, or LMA. It has to do simply with how much they run around. In the old days, when I started doing research, which is not the really old days, but it's pretty old, we used something called a stable limiter, or a shuttle box. We'd have a rectangular-shaped test apparatus, and it had a fulcrum or pivot point in the center, so when the rat ran back and forth from one end to the other, it gave a slight shift in the movement of the cage. And then we put a micro switch under one end, so when it was on one end, it would click the micro switch, and we could count how many times it clicked the micro switch or ran back and forth. Put that up to a counter, and voila, you have a measure of locomotor activity. It's actually ambulation throughout the cage. More modern ways of doing this, which for me began in the early 1980s, it's a really long time ago for you, would be using a photocell cage. And what we have there, we have photocell beams that will interrupt the longitudinal axis of the photocell chamber. And they go across the chamber in a way that now when the animal runs back and forth, it breaks a little photocell beam. And we use infrared photocells, which is outside the visual range for a rat. Rats can't see infrared any more than we can. So every time they break the photocell beam, they walk in between it, one transmitter and a corresponding receiver, we get a little count. Now it's all computer automated. As you give increasing doses of a stimulant, you increase ambulation in the cage, and you get more interruptions of those photocell beams. Or in a stable limiter, you get more crossing back and forth, the little clicks on your teeter-totter there, and that's a measure of locomotor activity. More photocell counts or more clicks on the stable limiter counter, what happens is you get more ambulation, more locomotor activity, which is related to arousal, and the higher the drug dose, the higher the locomotor stimulatory effect of these compounds. If we look at our reference compound now, cocaine, we see that we have some threshold dose below which you really don't produce much effect. Then as you start going up the dose sequence, you get a nice strong locomotor stimulation followed by doses now that as you increase the dose, you get no further increase in the magnitude of arousal, here again measured as locomotor activity. So that's the asymptotic, that's the upper asymptotic value. A measure of the efficacy of cocaine is a measure of how strong a locomotor stimulating effect does it have at its very best or very highest dose you can test. And that's given up here. When you compare these psychomotor stimulants back with amphetamine, comparison between cocaine and amphetamine shows that you can produce the same effects with amphetamine that are produced with cocaine, but it just requires somewhat different doses. And again, in this example, like the heroin example, it actually requires lower doses. What requires 10 milligrams per kilogram body weight to produce in a rat for locomotor activity with cocaine, you can produce with only 1 milligram per kilogram of diamphetamine sulfate. So in this case, the amphetamine is about 10 times more potent than is the cocaine. Now, if you want to look at another stimulant drug, caffeine in this case, you're going to find out that you can produce comparable stimulation and locomotor activity up to some maximum level with caffeine. But the maximum effect that can be obtained at any dose of caffeine that you can give the subject is well below the maximum effect that's obtainable with the cocaine or amphetamine. In other words, the efficacy of the caffeine is much lower than the efficacy of both cocaine and amphetamine. The potency is lower and the efficacy is lower. Two important parameters describing your dose response analysis. Now I'll enter a fourth compound, nicotine. Nicotine is a very potent substance. It takes very small amounts, microgram amounts, to produce an effect. If you look at our dose response curve, you'll see that low doses, this would be 3 micrograms, 10 micrograms, 30 micrograms of nicotine, all produce locomotor activity. But the maximum locomotor stimulation that you can produce with nicotine happens to be much lower than the maximum locomotor stimulation that can be produced with either amphetamine or with cocaine. In fact, the maximum stimulation that we see with nicotine is comparable to the maximum stimulation that we get with caffeine. How does this all relate back to drug addiction? Really, really obvious way is that addicts know about dose response curves too. They know the more drug they take, the larger the effect. The more drug they take, the larger effect, up to some maximum level. And they're always cruising up here on the near maximum effect, which is what brings the safety of the drug down. They're always very close to overdosing because they're always very close to pushing that drug to get as much out of it as they can. When you're dealing with a substance like caffeine, you would find that caffeine can perk you up in the morning and stimulate you, increase cognitive arousal, alertness, fight off fatigue and sleepiness. I needed another cup of coffee myself really badly before teaching class today, but didn't have enough time. What you need to pay attention to here from a psychopharmacologic standpoint is that you can produce comparable stimulation with either cocaine or amphetamine. It's just a question of changing the dose. You just have to take more cocaine than you would amphetamine to produce it. And you can produce some locomotor stimulation, arousal, increased cognitive functioning with your caffeine as well. But no matter how many cups of coffee you have, you're never going to get up to the effect that's being produced by a psychomotor stimulant like amphetamine or cocaine. On the other side of the curve, you have nicotine. Nicotine is much more potent, and when you say powerful, than is cocaine or amphetamine. It takes much lower doses. But the efficacy of the nicotine is much lower than the efficacy of the cocaine and the amphetamine. So no matter how hard you drag on that Marlboro, you're never going to get high like cocaine. And here's why I tell you this. David Kessler, the former head of the FDA, he said that smoking cigarettes is more addictive than smoking crack cocaine. We all know how addictive cocaine is. That's one way to take it. Cocaine's addictive, so I wouldn't possibly try a cigarette. Another way to take it is I saw mom and dad, they used to smoke and they quit. And it wasn't that hard. They quit. So I guess if crack cocaine is less addictive than cigarettes, I might as well smoke a little crack. But coming back to how this works, he's partially true. Not that it's just like, but that it could be just like. Effect from nicotine or from caffeine is like a low dose effect from cocaine or amphetamine. So they share that similarity. But what happens is, as you increase the dose of either caffeine or nicotine, you're never going to get to the effect that's produced by a true psychomotor stimulant like cocaine and amphetamine. In other words, the efficacy of the compound is way too low. Therapeutic index simply compares the therapeutic safety of a drug back with the toxic effect of the drug. And the comparison point used here is related again to the ED50. What they do is they take the ED50 for the therapeutic effect of the drug, which would be shown here on the left-hand side, requires lower doses of drug than it does to produce this other effect we're looking at, which is related to the toxic effect of the drug. So they have to run out a dose response curve for the toxic effect of the drug, the endpoint usually being fatality. They look at little mice, little rats dying. They don't use primates for this. Primates, they'll look at maybe some other toxic effect. And the interspecies differences can be dramatic. Thalidomide is the classic example where something got passed okay in the rodent test and in the tissue culture test. and it was put then into millions of mothers in Europe, and we got all these kids that have deformed arms, the drug from thalidomide from back in the 70s. So testing in primates can be important too. There can be interspecies differences. But normally you use laboratory rats or mice. And what you do is you get varying doses of the drug and you measure an endpoint. The traditional endpoint is the point of death. That would be what we call a quantile or graded dose response. Quantile. You're either dead or not dead. Only when I flatline you on morphine and give you naloxone are you half dead. Okay? You're dead. Quantile. Either dead or not dead. So you do a quantile dose response curve here with lethality being the endpoint. And you determine the LD50. It's called now the lethal dose 50, the dose required to kill half your animals. You take that number, in this example would be 300 milligrams, and compare that with the dose required to produce the therapeutic effect in half your animals. In this case, it's 30 milligrams. And you divide 300 by 30, it gives you what's called the therapeutic index, or TI. The larger the TI, the safer the drug. This particular example, the lethal effect starts kicking in here when you're reaching near maximum therapeutic effects. The TI in this particular case would be TI of 10. That is not a safe drug. Where that really comes into play is some drugs have a big TI and some have a small TI. Barbiturates have been used for a long time for the sedative hypnotic properties being sleep-inducing. And when they're used for a sleep aid to people, what happened is there wasn't that big a difference between what it takes to put you to sleep and what it takes to kill you. So you would have on your nightstand maybe a bottle of phenobarbital that would be sufficient to kill you if you took more than the one prescribed tablet. The therapy index of that was small. When the barbiturates fell out of favor because the benzodiazepines hit the market, benzodiazepines can also be used as a sedative hypnotic at higher doses. What happens is the therapeutic index for benzodiazepines is much higher. So now what you have on your nightstand to put you to sleep is usually not a lethal dose of your benzodiazepine or other sleep aid that you might be prescribed. In other words, you don't take the whole bottle, the whole month's supply, but if you get confused in the night, think you're reaching for an aspirin, and you down your diazepam, it's not going to kill you with the same certainty that if you downed your bottle of phenobarbital. Now, therapeutic index and drug addiction. Drug addicts aren't looking at therapeutic effects, but it's the same principle. They got a high they're looking for, a maximum effect of the drug usually, and that has a relatively safe margin that will correspond back to the therapeutic index. So therapeutic index, half-life, and these ED50 are all parameters in standard pharmacology that you look up, and they're not exact numbers that you would use to translate into street drugs and drug abuse, but they reflect those numbers. They do correspond to those numbers. Higher ED50 means the addict would take less. Larger TI would mean it's a relatively safe drug compared to relatively not safe. By the way, I do not do lethal experiments in animals, never have deliberately. Don't grimace at me. I'm a pleasure guy. I study reward systems in the brain. I make my rats happy.
These podcasts are copyright 2012 by the Addiction Science Network. They are produced in collaboration with the State University of New York at Buffalo and are provided solely for educational purposes. Podcasts can be directly downloaded from www.addictionscience.net. Transcripts are also available for some podcasts at our website, as are other documents and commentaries regarding drug addiction and select topics on psychopharmacology. These podcasts can be copied and freely distributed as long as the source is acknowledged and provided they are not edited in a manner which changes the fundamental meaning of the selected passages when quoted out of context of the entire presentation. Correspondence from professional colleagues is welcomed and can be sent to info@addictionscience.net. We do not offer clinical services, nor do we usually have time to reply to questions emailed from the general public. When listening, please keep in mind that these podcasts are targeted for academic and professional listeners. Everyone is invited to share any information they find useful, but our target audience is not the general public. Finally, please note that the Addiction Science Network is the sole author of this work, and views and opinions expressed herein should not be construed as official policy of the State University of New York.